You're listening to The Wake Up Reads with Alex Svetsky, the show where I read the best articles, excerpts, and essays in the world of Bitcoin, philosophy, and contrarian thinking. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Wake Up Reads. On today's episode, I'm going to continue reading out of The Most Dangerous Superstition by Larkin Rose. And actually, I'm going to extend on the idea that we covered last episode, which was the It's Not My Job syndrome. And in particular, what we're going to cover today is the Milgram experiment, or it could be the Milgram experiments. I think it was a whole series of experiments. And I want to cover this on this episode, and then probably in a future episode, I'm going to cover the Ash experiment, which is another one, which is quite interesting. For those of you who are interested, go look it up. You'll see what it is. There's a great clip of it on, I don't know if they've probably banned it from YouTube, who knows, but it kind of shows you why people will conform to a lie under social pressure. But the Milgram experiment itself is more about authority. So what I'll do here is I'm going to read the excerpt from the book itself, and then we'll go in and we'll do a bit of a dissection of what this experiment is. So hope you find this useful. And without further ado, here comes the read from Larkin Rose's book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, The Milgram Experiments. In brief, the Milgram studies were designed to determine to what degree ordinary people would inflict pain upon strangers simply because an authority figure told them to. For the complete description of the experiments and the results, see Dr. Milgram's book, Obedience to Authority. The following is a short synopsis of his experiments and findings. Subjects were asked to volunteer for what they were told was an experiment testing human memory. Under the supervision of a scientist, the authority figure, one person was strapped into a chair and wired with electrodes, and the other, the actual subject of the study, sat in front of a shock-generating machine. The person in front of the zapper machine was told that the goal was to test whether shocking the other person when he gave a wrong answer to a memorization question would affect his ability to remember things. The true goal, however, was to test to what degree the person in front of the zapper machine would inflict pain on an innocent stranger simply because someone in the role of authority told him to. The zapper machine had a series of switches going up to 450 volts, and the zapper subject was supposed to increase the voltage and administer another shock each time the zappee got an answer wrong. In truth, the zappee in the test was an actor who was not being shocked at all, but at given voltage levels would give shouts of pain, protests about heart troubles, and demands to stop the experiment, screams for mercy, and eventually silence, feigning either unconsciousness or death. In addition, the zapper machine was clearly marked with danger labels at the upper end of the series of switches. The results of the experiment shocked even Dr. Milgram. In short, a significant majority of subjects, nearly 2 out of 3, continued through the experiment right to the end, inflicting what they thought were excruciatingly painful, if not lethal, shocks to a complete stranger, despite the screams of agony, the cries for mercy, even the unconsciousness or death of the pretending victim. Dr. Milgram himself succinctly sums up the conclusion to be reached. And I quote here Dr. Milgram, "With numbing regularity, good people were seen to knuckle under the demands of authority and perform actions that were callous and severe. A substantial proportion of people do what they are told to do, irrespective of the content of the act and without limitations of conscience, so long as they perceive that the command comes from a legitimate authority." End quote. Of note, in the experiments, there was no threat that the zapper would be punished for failure to obey, nor was there any special reward promised for obedience. So the results were not merely showing that an ordinary person might hurt someone else to save his own neck or to somehow protect himself. Instead, the results showed that most people will inflict excruciating pain, even death, upon an innocent stranger for no other reason than that he was told to by a perceived authority. This point cannot be overstressed. There is a particular belief that leads basically good people to do bad things, even heinously evil things. Even the atrocities of Hitler's Third Reich were the result, not of millions of evil people, but of a very small handful of truly supposedly evil people who had acquired positions of authority, and millions of obedient people who merely did what the perceived authority told them to do. In her book about Hitler's top bureaucrat, Adolf Eichmann, sometimes called the architect of the Holocaust, author Hannah Arendt used the phrase the banality of evil to refer to the fact that most evil is not the result of personal malice or hatred, but merely the result of blind obedience. Individuals giving up their own free will and judgment in favor of unthinking subservience to an imagined authority. Interestingly, both Arendt's book and Dr. Milgram's experiments offended a whole lot of people. The reason is simple. People who have been taught to respect authority and have been taught that obedience is a virtue and that cooperating with authority is what makes us civilized do not like to hear the truth, which is that truly evil people, with all their malice and hatred, pose far less of a threat to mankind than the basically good people who believe in authority. Anyone who honestly examines the results of Dr. Milgram's experiments cannot escape that fact of reality. But aside from the general lesson to be learnt from the Milgram experiments, that most people will intentionally hurt other people if perceived authority tells them to, several of the findings from Milgram's work are worth noting. Many of the subjects of the experiments showed signs of stress, guilt, and anguish while inflicting pain on others, and yet continued doing so. This fact demonstrates that these were not simply nasty sadists waiting for an excuse to hurt others. They did not even enjoy doing it. Furthermore, it shows that the people knew that what they were doing was wrong, but did it anyway because authority told them to. Some subjects even protested. They begged to be allowed to stop. They trembled uncontrollably, even cried, and yet most continued to the end of the experiment. The conclusion could hardly be more obvious. The belief in authority makes good people commit evil. Number two, the subject's income level, education level, age, sex, and other demographic factors seem to have little or no influence on the results. Statistically speaking, a rich, cultured, educated young woman will obey an authoritarian command to hurt someone else just as readily as an illiterate, poor, male manual laborer will. The one common factor shared by all of those who continued to the end of the experiment is that they believed in authority, obviously. Again, the message to be learnt, however troubling it may be, is logically inescapable. Regardless of almost any other factors, the belief in authority turns good people into agents of evil. Number three, the average person, when the experiment is described to him, not including the results, guesses that the compassion and conscience of most people would prevent them from continuing through to the end of the entire experiment. Professional psychiatrists predicted that only about 1 in 1,000 would obey to the end of the experiment, when in reality it was about 65%. And when the average person who has not actually been tested is asked if he personally would have gone to the end of the study if he had been tested, he usually insists that he would not have. Yet the majority do. Again, the message is troubling but indisputable. Almost everyone hugely underestimates the degree to which the belief in authority, even in himself, can be used to persuade good people to commit evil. Number 4. Dr. Milgram also found that some test subjects, defying all reason, were determined to blame the results of their own blind obedience on the victim, the one being shocked. In other words, through whatever twisted mentality it took, some of those doing the shocking imagined that the one being shocked was somehow to blame for his own suffering. With that in mind, it should come as no surprise that when police officers are caught assaulting innocent civilians, or when soldiers are caught terrorizing or murdering civilians, or when prison guards are caught torturing prisoners, their defense is often to blame the victim, no matter how much the authoritarian aggressives have to mangle the truth and logic in order to do so. Interestingly, even though at the Nuremberg trials, just following orders was not accepted as a valid excuse for what the Nazis did, it is still the standard response from countless soldiers, police, tax collectors, bureaucrats, and the other representatives of authority whenever the morality of their behavior is questioned. Both in Milgram's experiments and in countless real-life abuses of power, those who intentionally hurt others simply fall back on the standard excuse, claiming that they were not personally responsible because they were merely following orders. In the Milgram experiments, several subjects even directly asked the authority figure which of them was responsible for what was happening. When the authority figure said that he was the one responsible, most subjects went on without further debate, apparently comfortable with the notion that whatever happened from then on was not their fault and they would not be held liable. Again, the message is difficult to escape. The belief in authority allows basically good people to dissociate themselves from the evil acts they themselves commit, relieving them of any feeling of personal responsibility. Number 5. When it was left up to the zapper what voltage to use, only very rarely would he go above 150 volts, the point at which the one pretending to be shocked said he did not want to go on. It is very important to note that up to that point, and almost all subjects made it to that point, the zappy let out grunts of pain, but did not ask for the experiment to stop. As a result, the one doing the zapping could quite reasonably say that the one being zapped had agreed to the arrangement, and up to that point was still a willing participant. Interestingly, of the few subjects who did not go all the way to the end, many of them stopped as soon as the zappy said he wanted out. This could be dubbed the libertarian line, since once the zappy asked to be unstrapped, for the zapper to continue anyway constitutes initiating violence against another, the exact thing libertarians opposed. Unfortunately, those who stop at the libertarian line are only a small minority of the population. As for the rest, the findings are disturbingly clear. Of the people who would, at the behest of authority, shock someone who calmly said, "I don't want to do this anymore," most would continue inflicting pain, even if the victim was screaming in agony. Is this because most people are evil? No. It is because they have been conditioned to do as they are told and have been indoctrinated into the most dangerous superstition of all, i.e. the belief in authority. It should be noted that even Dr. Milgram could not escape his own indoctrination into the cult of authority worship. In passing, and with very little comment, even he opined, quote, "We cannot have a society without some structure of authority," end quote. He made a weak attempt to defend teaching obedience to authority by saying, quote, "Obedience is often rational. It makes good sense to follow the doctor's orders, to obey traffic signs, and to clear the buildings when the police inform us of a bomb threat," end quote. Yet, none of those examples actually requires or justifies a belief in authority. Despite the way people often talk, doctors do not give orders. They are authorities in the sense that they are knowledgeable in the field of medicine, but not in the sense of having any right to rule. As for the other examples, the main reason to observe the rules of the road or to leave a building with a bomb in it is not because obedience to authority is a virtue, but because the alternative is injury or death. If some non-authority in a theater pulled a bomb from under his seat, held it up for all to see and said, "A bomb, let's get out of here," would everyone else stay where they were because the person was not perceived as an authority? Of course not. And if government repealed the law saying which side of the road everyone should drive on, would people start randomly swerving around? Of course not. They would keep driving on the right side because they do not want to crash into each other. So although even Dr. Milgram clung to the notion that the belief in authority is sometimes necessary and good, he gave no rational argument to support such an assertion. It is a testament to the strength of the myth of authority that even someone who had witnessed what Dr. Milgram had witnessed was still unable to completely give up the superstition. After Dr. Milgram publicized his findings, many were shocked and dismayed by the extent to which normal people were willing to inflict pain or death upon innocent strangers when instructed to do so by a perceived authority. Similar tests performed since Dr. Milgram's experiments have yielded similar results, which continue to shock some people. However, the results really should not be surprising to anyone who has taken a look at how most human beings are raised. Man, that was a fascinating section of the book. It's interesting even how Dr. Milgram, who's the guy performing these experiments and actually showing how blind obedience to authority can lead people to perform heinous acts, even he's sort of gripped by that same myth of authority, and he tries to do some sort of mental gymnastics to suggest that authority is the reason why people behave. And this is sort of the classic statist misconception, which assumes, and Bastiat talks about this a lot. He says that, and I'm going to butcher the quote here from Bastiat, but something along the lines of, when, you know, what statists would believe is that those of us who oppose government-funded or government-managed food operations would prefer to starve, right? Or those who oppose government-funded or government-organized education would prefer to be illiterate, which is not the case. And I guess what Larkin Rose is saying here is that those examples that Milgram gave about like a bomb or, you know, driving on the wrong side of the light or whatever the case is, they're not, you know, following those rules, customs, norms are not a function of an authority telling you to do so. They're a function of fucking common sense. Just like, you know, I guess I don't want to say free market anymore, because I had a conversation with Cavallo recently where he challenged the notion of free market. He actually gave a very good kind of explanation why no markets are actually free. Markets are either centrally regulated by some sort of authority, there's that word again, or they're mutually regulated by the parties of each side of the transaction agreeing to a custom or a set of rules. Now, I guess this is kind of semantics in a sense, because when we think about free markets, we think of the cooperative form of regulation where people agree to a set of rules in the marketplace by which they operate. So anyway, if we assume that that's the definition of free market just for the moment, so that I can, you know, maybe I should call it like a market free of coercion, perhaps, or a mutually agreed upon market. But let's just call it free market for the moment without getting all fucking tangled up in semantics here. The whole point, and this is what statists miss, and this is what people like Milgram seem to have missed as well, despite running this experiment, is that when you allow people to interact amongst each other, you know, they're not going to just go around fucking beating each other over the head. Yes, that might happen in some cases. And yes, there are genuinely either fucking retarded, bad, evil, whatever kind of people you want to place there that will prefer to coerce instead of cooperate. They are actually the exception to the norm. And the challenge when you build a state built around fiat authority, what ends up happening is that these so-called thugs or these so-called evil people, they end up finding their way into that. So they have the protection of the state apparatus. They have the protection of this perceived authority to then perpetrate their coercion in a legal format, right? So anyway, this is such an interesting experiment. I want to go back to a few of the parts and kind of pull some threads on there, which I thought were quite interesting. So in number two, he mentions the subject's income level, education level, et cetera, et cetera. So that, you know, a woman basically who's, you know, rich, cultured, young, and educated is as likely to obey as some poor manual laborer would. I kind of question this one because I feel like, you know, it reminds me of that meme, which is, you know, that kind of middle of the bell curve person who goes to university and is indoctrinated because they've spent so much time in the indoctrination camps, they tend to obey more, whereas the left-hand side of the bell curve manual laborer kind of goes a little bit more by instinct. So, you know, maybe they don't obey as much. I don't know. That's an interesting one, but I guess it would be worth exploring the kind of archetypes of people. I mean, he uses the terminology about the line of the libertarian, right? Which is the person who, once the other person has said they don't want to go on, they refuse to proceed. And what's interesting is that's a much smaller number of people. But I wonder what the archetype of person is and what the relationship between the nature and nurture of that individual is, who would effectively be the person who doesn't proceed with the experiment, or who was the person who was, you know, hiding Jews during the Nazi period, or whatever other period, right? The people who bucked the trend, like, you know, the remnant, the people who didn't wear fucking masks and face diapers when we were told to, right? Who didn't get jabbed and were remaining to be purebloods. So I wonder what that archetype is. So that was an interesting finding. It would be interesting to run that again in sort of a modern age and kind of pick Bitcoiners and, you know, maybe shitcoiners and no-coiners and do kind of like a broad thing. I think there would be a skew towards Bitcoiners being non-agreeable, but obviously the test is going to need to be transformed because too many people are going to know about this shit now. The other part that's interesting, obviously, number three, is that most people overestimate themselves. And this ties into what Jordan Peterson talks about, particularly when he discusses this idea of one must become a monster. Like, one must cultivate that part of them, the ability to say fucking no. And that's quite rare. And, you know, he discusses how most people are probably, through their you know, desire to conform and through their desire to obey, and I don't know if we should even call it desire, maybe a propensity or proclivity, right, to use Peterson's words, their proclivity to obey and to conform, and this is probably associated with the Ash experiment actually as well, is they are so-called good people, but they're weak. And the weak person is going to be more likely to obey, whereas the strong person, the person who has cultivated that monster inside them, is more likely to say fuck you and stand up to this fiat, fake, perceived authority. And that's really important. I think for me, that was one of the big... I remember when I was in Germany in 2020 and it was, you know, middle shitstorm COVID, and, you know, I was going fucking crazy at the time, thinking, what the hell is this world coming to? People have fucking lost their minds. Like, everything that was staring me in the face was a blatant lie. Like, I'd catch the tram, going to the gym, refused to wear a fucking mask. I was lucky that I found one gym, actually, where they didn't bother with the masks and any of that bullshit. It was kind of like an old school bodybuilder's gym. But it was just staring me in the face, and, like, that period was when I got radicalized. Actually, if you want to hear a funny episode, go back to episode 50 of the General Wake Up podcast. I've actually got a throwback to a show, or it was actually, what was the name of it now? I think it was Value of Bitcoin Conference. That's right. And it was the first digitally held one. And I went on this mega rant about how fucking retarded the world is. And it never got aired because I think I triggered too many people at the time. But 2 years on from that interview, I did an episode and it was quite good. So anyway, that's episode 50. But I was in the midst of that, and I remember at the gym, I was just going through and listening to Jordan Peterson clips, basically. That was my whole thing. I was just devouring all of his work. And one of his, you know, really beautiful pieces of work is the idea that the best men are dangerous and the best men are monsters. And he uses Jocko Willink as a good example, and he is a good example. Those young men, those teenagers who are most likely to disobey and to get in trouble, that spirit, I guess, is the spirit of freedom. And if you can tie that into some sort of morality and integrity over time, and I think this is also, this must be a nature thing, and this is probably where nature and nurture kind of align, is if that spirit of person has a strong role model, they have the ability to become a leader in the truest sense of the term. And a leader is someone who doesn't follow orders and fucking obey just because somebody else told them to. They do it, and they will follow an order if it's the correct or the right thing to do based on their internal sense of morality. They have this internal barometer, this internal compass of what's important. So this for me echoes really strongly and is a big reason why I think that the statistics are as they are in the Milgram experiments, is that 65% of people went all the way through to the fucking end because some authority figure told them to, and they justified it. Like, you know, they even wanted to weasel their own fucking way out of it by saying, oh, you know, am I going to get in trouble for this, or are you going to take responsibility? So this is that ass covering of responsibility that Francis and I and Dave Bradley spoke about in the first Remnant episode back in 2020, right? When we started the whole fucking Remnant thing, is that the world has become this constant attempt to cover your own ass and play responsibility fucking hot potato and send it to someone else. And this experiment is a perfect example of how people obey authority. And so long as they can remove their own agency, they will bow to whatever the fuck whatever authority tells them to do. And, you know, this is why Bitcoin is such an affront, not just to the financial system and, you know, it's a better money and all that sort of shit. Bitcoin's very DNA is about responsibility. It is an affront to everything that is going on in the world today. Like, I've called it in my writings, like, Bitcoin is responsibility go up technology. Yeah, number go up is fucking fantastic. And with number go up, we get fuck you money and fuck you wealth and fuck you purchasing power, so that we have the ability to do bigger and better and greater things. But simultaneously, our responsibility also goes up. And in fact, the greater your, I guess, score is, to use Carvalho's terminology, but the greater your Bitcoin score is, the greater your responsibility is. And if you do not don that responsibility forthrightly, then you're either going to squander the shit, you're going to lose the shit, you may even get fucking capped, because in a Bitcoin world where responsibility and integrity starts to become more important, kind of the dynamics of, you know, the dynamics between people change a little bit. So anyway, I don't want to get off on a tangent there. I want to kind of focus on this Milgram stuff here. So we've gone through sort of 2, 3, 4, 5, number four actually is, and this one's funny actually, is the subset of people who, while they're inflicting pain on someone else, decide that it's the person who's being hurt, it's their fucking fault. And do you know what? In a way, sometimes I can understand this, because sometimes, I don't know, you see these people who are fucking like lemming-like, and I don't mean to sound like an asshole here, because this is not the point of it, but it's something that, you know, because I'm an empathic person, but I think I have some potentially psychopathic tendencies, in the sense that when someone really does piss me off or get on the wrong side of me, or, you know, is wearing 3 fucking face diapers and suffocating themselves while they're walking on a treadmill, like, I have no remorse for that person. I don't give a fuck what happens to them. You know, fuck them. They can suffocate. They can do whatever the fuck they want. So there comes a point where, you know, I have a bit of a disdain. But the thing is, I think where the difference between me and, you know, maybe what some of these people are doing, and this is probably where we enter the realm of the psychopath, is that they're actually the ones inflicting the pain. And I guess this kind of reminds me of, you know, when you've watched or read kind of films or books about the Nazis and, you know, what they were doing with the Jews and stuff like that. And this is, you know, not just them. It was what the commies did to fucking 10 times more people. In fact, with the Russians and in China and everywhere else. So there's much bigger fucking atrocities in the world than what the Nazis did. But in any case, like, it gives me that image of, you know, these sort of people who look and are pathetic, and you kind of want to, you know, tread on them further. And that's kind of sad. I think, I don't know what to say about that, except that, you know, there must be the tendency of a psychopath. So I wonder what the percentage of people kind of fit that mold. And I guess in particular roles of authority, so whether it's so-called law enforcement or military or whatever, I think probably also bureaucratic, very much so in politics, those kind of people, that kind of archetype of person would probably exist. You know, they'd kind of look down on, you know, the working class who are paying $5 a fucking gallon for fuel at the moment and have a disdain for them. Be like, oh, fuck them. It's their fault. So anyway, I think we'll wrap up this piece with just this notion. And again, this ties into the direction I really want to take with this podcast, is about compliance and obedience being the pathway to hell, basically. And, you know, these so-called good compliant lemmings in many cases, and this ties back into all the stuff that we've discussed over the last few episodes about the Remnant series, right? It's these weaponized lemmings, these obedient masses who pose the greatest threat to humanity, because they're not evil per se. They're just, and, you know, like as Hannah Arendt would have said, you know, it's the banality of evil. They, in the process of following orders and obeying the authority who's told them to do X, Y, Z. And sometimes that authority, you know, doesn't always have to be an evil authority with some fucking plan. It can be a moronic, incompetent, stupid authority. And in the absence of individual agency, in the absence of you being able to say fucking no and to think for yourself, which is something that is continually happening in the world today, right? People are giving up agency. They're giving up their own capacity to think, and they're outsourcing it to government, to fucking media, to influencers and celebrities and Hollywood and fucking experts, right? What happens is people are not capable of thinking for themselves anymore. And as such, in order to make a decision, which you have to make, they just obey and they comply. Like, I fucking hate that word, compliant. One of my most hated words. I think that's why I love contrapliant so much. So, yeah, like he says in point number one here, which is kind of the extension points, where, you know, most of these people, they were like sweating, they, you know, they felt guilty, they had anguish, they were shaking or whatever, but they still fucking did it. So they did something that was, you know, their nervous system was grinding them the wrong way, and it was sending them signals. But because they've been numbed into compliant submission by this, you know, fucking phantom authority known as primarily the state, they've basically, you know, got learned helplessness, and they behave more like sheep than like humans. So I guess the lesson to take away from this is, number one, is we all need to be aware of this shit. And this is a fantastic experiment that validates my position on, you know, the masses and the lemmings, etc. It validates also that there is only a small subset of people who are the remnant, which is that libertarian line. So people who will say no, despite what the authority says. It validates the concept of the banality of evil, that evil is more to do with compliance than it is to do with some, you know, lizards behind red fucking curtains. But I think the takeaway for you listening to this episode is that in order to, I guess, move the world closer toward heaven, what's required is that those of us who still have the capacity to think for ourselves and have the capacity to remain, well, I don't know if remain is the right word, but to maintain integrity with our internal moral compass, we need to develop the monster inside. We need to develop that strong, tough, fuck you energy version of ourselves, because we need to call upon it. And particularly in the day and age that we're in now, like, we're going through what is the most retarded version of World War III possible. The hand-to-hand combat element is kind of all gone now because of the risks of nuking ourselves. So we need to bring that fucking energy up from inside of us. And whether that involves going and doing some sort of martial arts, whether that involves sharpening your mind through listening to these things, through reading, you know, more controversial stuff, not just the fucking run-of-the-mill shit that, you know, everyone's reading, like Sapiens by Yuval Harari, right? I'm talking like read some punchy stuff, like this book, for example, or listen to my damn podcast, whatever. Go and learn to fucking shoot. Train at the gym. Lift heavy fucking shit. Build a business. Like, go and, you know, these days I'm a little bit funny on building a business because, you know, part of me, you know, has gone full Ayn Randian in the sense that you don't want to build anything to feed these motherfuckers, but go build a Bitcoin business that sits outside of the system and does not feed the beast. Okay, maybe that's a better idea. Do all of these things. If you're a fucking man particularly, you need to be the fucking monster. You need to build that wall. You need to build that presence. You need to build that groundedness and that foundation so that you have the capacity to not only protect and play defense, but to also attack when is needed. And the attack starts with the ability to say fucking no and stand up. It reminds me of that image that I saw that was going around. It was that, that Turkish guy he looked in Berlin, and he was fucking massive alpha beefcake looking motherfucker who was just staring down that piece of shit cop during the freedom protests and the, you know, people protesting against the mask mandates. That's the fucking energy you want. So anyway, I've gone on enough. If you like this, please let me know. Send me a boost. Drop me a comment on Fountain. That's the best way to interact with me. Or tag me on Twitter or some shit like that and let me know if you enjoyed this. I've got more coming. I think next week I'm going to go and read an older essay about the war is the health of the state. So it was an essay written in 1918. It's gonna be quite long, so I might do that over two episodes. But if you're enjoying the excerpts from this book in particular, let me know if you'd like me to pull some more out, because I think this book is fantastic and it's just got some really nice bite-sized sections that I think are quite useful. So I hope you enjoyed it. Share this around. Remember to subscribe. Drop me some comments, some boosts, whatever the fuck you want to do there on Fountain, and I will see you on the next episode of The Wake Up Reads. Thank you for listening to The Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read them in tweet and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating plague that is consuming our world.